Okay, today one-on-one comes to you from the home of Pete and Alice Dye on Cricket Stick Golf Course, and it's a great honor to be with you, Pete. You're such a legendary figure in the world of golf and in the history of Indiana golf. And I'd like to talk about the beginning of your story. I know you were born in Urbana, Ohio. Your father's name was Pink, his nickname. How did he get that nickname?
He had red hair when he was a kid, and they called him Pinky. And but his real name was Paul F. Dye. And a lot of people call him by his initials, P.F., but a lot of people that really knew him for a long time called him Pinky.
Okay. Now, he was active in the golf world, right?
Well, yes. My dad was in World War I, and he married my mom in 1921 or 2 or 3, someplace of that era. But he was in politics, and he was driving from Urbana, Ohio, to Washington, D.C. on old Federal Highway 40, and is going through Uniontown, Pennsylvania, and his car broke down. So he stayed up at the Mount Airy, the little inn on top of the, right outside of Uniontown, and that's where a lot of the presidents used to stay. But they had a 9-hole golf course, so while they were working on his car, he decided to go up and hit a few golf balls. He never had played golf, and he got hooked. And the next thing you knew, he was from Washington back to Urbana, and my mother's family had some farmland close to Urbana, and one of them was just hilly, and all they did is graze cows or something on it, or nobody, or they didn't use it much. And he went out and got a group of people and formed a club, and he built 9 holes on her farm. And then recently, well, more recently, my younger son built the second 9. I think he built that in 70 years later, so it was in 1993 or 4. But there's 18 holes, and the Urbana Country Club does quite well.
Oh, so Urbana Country Club now, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's Urbana Country Club.
So it's got a lot of history. And you obviously began playing at a young age.
Well, yes, but as soon as I could hold a hose, my dad had me out there watering the greens. And then as soon as I got a little bigger, I was cutting the grass and cutting the greens. With the greens mower, you had to push it. There's no motor. And it go back and forth on the slope, so it wouldn't be so hard to push. And then the superintendent, Ernie Wilson, he had to go into the war started, and he had to go to work in a defense plant. And I was 16 or 17, and they made me the greenkeeper, and had my brother, and so and a couple other kids. And finally, I burned up all the greens, and my dad volunteered me for the parachute infantry. So I went in the service in early 1944.
Your dad kind of fired you, huh?
Yeah. And then I came back during World War II. I was with the parachute infantry, and we jumped out all over North Carolina and Georgia. I never went overseas, but when Harry Truman dropped that president over there, they brought us all back to Fort Bragg, and I had about 6 months to go in the service, and they made me the greenkeeper of the Fort Bragg golf course, and I stayed there. And then eventually I married Alice. I met her in college and married Alice in 1950, and I was still interested in golf course maintenance, so I went up to Purdue and took all their short courses in agronomy and never passed any of them, but I went up there for about 10 years. And I was always interested in the agronomy section of Purdue.
You never passed any of those courses.
No, I didn't do too good.
You weren't a student. You were more practical, I guess, huh?
Back and forth.
Well, let's go back up a little bit. You were the state champion in Ohio, right?
I know. I
high school?
In high school, I won the Ohio State Championship before the war, I think. The old golf course, the university golf course. And then I went to semifinals in the state amateur, and I was medalist a couple of times for the U.S. Amateur Championship when I was still in Ohio.
Mm-hmm. Did your dad teach you? Was he your...
My dad was... I told you my dad married my mom in 23, so when I was 7 or 8 years of age, my dad was a good player by then. In 7 or 8 years, he learned to be a good player. And really, he was always interested in golf, and he was the president of the Urbana Country Club, and then Green's chairman and this and so forth. And it, right before the war, the Ohio State golf team, out of the 8 people on the golf team, 6 were from Urbana that dad had worked on. 6 young men. And one of them won the Big Ten. His name was Chick Evans, like Chick Evans from Chicago.
Yeah.
But my dad was always interested in golf, and he loved golf. And he played a lot of good golf.
So you go from, when you're a high school student and you're the state champion, is your dream to be on the PGA Tour someday?
I never gave it a thought at all. And when I went to, after the service, and I went to school in Orlando at Rollins, and they had the PGA Championship down there. And I remember the second year, I think Hogan won it. But I was interested in the PGA, but I never had any wild ideas of joining the PGA. I watched Hogan and Nelson and Snead play, and I didn't play near that caliber. But at that time, if you were had certain amateur qualifications, you could play on the tour. So in the summertime, I always played 3 or 4 of the events.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you're in the Army during World War II. You're training to be a paratrooper. So you're, at that time, I guess, fully expected to be in combat, right?
Yeah. See, I went in 44, and of course, the war was not coming to an end, but it was getting more on our side in the 40s. And they trained the 13th Airborne to move into Korea. And we're going in to invade into Korea and come into Japan on the backside. And so we trained in the mountains around Asheville, but we were at Fort Bragg where we're stationed. And we'd go, of course, they never told us what we're doing or why we're doing all this jumping into a hilly country, but they planned to jump into Korea and come into the backside. And actually, the funny thing happened, I went into the service with a fellow by the name Chester Dabrisky. We were in at the same time, same event, same caliber, same stripe, private all the time. And we were in about a year and a half together. And when we went out to California to get on the boat to go to Korea, I never got on the boat. I was going on the next boat. He got on it for one day. And so he was in for a day on the boat. But somehow or another, got our names mixed up. They had me on the boat and him on the ground. So when we got back to Fort Bragg, they lined us all up. And if you had so many points, you stayed in the United States, and the rest of them went to Japan for occupational duty. And I was 1 point to the good, and I just waved to him as he left to go to Japan.
So you got a huge break there. By a misunderstanding, you got to stay in the States.
And so I got to stay there at Fort Bragg, and they made me the greenkeeper, finally, of the Fort Bragg golf course, and it had all sand greens, so I couldn't burn them up. And I used to go over and play Pinehurst. It was only 30 miles away. And that's where I met Donald Ross and all his people that worked for him. And of course, he had built the little golf course over at Fort Bragg. So we talked about the golf course a little bit.
At that time, were you starting to think you might want to be a designer someday?
No, I didn't give it a thought. But I always liked the maintenance of golf courses.
Okay.
Very much so. Always been, still to this very day, very interested in golf course maintenance.
Now, did you really get fired by your dad? Did you really screw up and get fired?
Oh, yeah. I was about ready to go in the service anyhow because of 18, just being on 18. And I always say he took me down and volunteered for the parachute infantry, but that's where I wanted to go anyhow.
Yeah. When the war ended, were you in any way disappointed you didn't get to follow through on your paratrooper training?
And I always thought that, we were going to get shipped overseas, and then the war in Germany came at an end in 45, in I think May or June, whatever it was. And then of course, in August, Mr. Truman stopped the war.
But dropped the bomb.
We were on our way overseas when I got, of course, in August of 45, and we were in California, and we were on these big boats, and the whole 13th Airborne Division was out there, and they moved us all out there, and we were going someplace, and they didn't tell us where, but we thought we were going someplace. But I was glad to come back to Fort Bragg.
Yeah, and your buddy who had to go to Japan because of that misunderstanding, did he hold that against you? Or did it work out okay for him?
No, he was all right. He got along fine.
Okay. So as you said, you went to Rollins College in Florida, and that's where you met Alice.
Right.
And Alice is from Indianapolis, though, so yeah. Why was she going to Rollins College in Florida?
Well, she was a very good student, and she told her dad that if she got certain grades, she could pick out her own university. And Alice wanted to go south because she wanted to play golf.
Mm-hmm.
And she got into Rollins. And when I got to Rollins, Alice was a junior or a senior. I forget now. But that's where, and I was going to be 23. Yeah, 22 or 23. When I started school, and I was just a freshman. But I met her down there at school.
Yeah.
And we both played golf together and all that. I had a lot of fun.
Who was the better golfer then?
Yeah, right.
No, who was the better golfer then between you and Alice?
I still could hold my own.
You could still beat her?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you two compete against one another quite a bit in golf in a friendly kind of way? I mean, did you?
Well, no, we never competed about each other, but we played a lot of golf together and they used to have a two ball down there where they had pros, two pros playing, or a pro and an amateur, or amateur and amateur. And we played together as an amateur and amateur and played a lot of the good professionals. That's when Babe Sir Harris was playing so well.
Uh-huh.
And all those good players. And Alice played a lot of golf with Babe Sir Harris, knew Patty Berg, played with her. So she's played with more people than anybody. Alice has played with Snead and Byron Nelson and all the pros, and she even beat Dottie Pepper just before Dottie turned pro. And Alice played in the National Amateur and played in the Women's Open Championship and played in the British and won everything you could think of. So Alice played a lot of golf.
Yeah.
And then I always say she knows more about the game because on Tuesday she goes out here to Crooked Stick or down at Gulfstream and plays 18 holes with three ladies that can't break 100. So she's had that variety from Babe Sir Harris to the people that shoot 110.
Yeah.
And nobody's had that. And every time I'm working on a golf course, she'll come out and look at it when we're pretty close to being done. She'll say, how in the world is Mary Smith going to play this hole?
Yeah.
So she always asks that. Okay.
We can edit that out. It's no problem.
Okay.
So she takes into consideration the average woman player.
Oh, sure,
on a golf
absolutely.
Course.
And she knows. And then on the par threes, you know, ladies can always, you can always have a ladies tee. So all the par threes that I've built, and I get, they say that I'm a guard, and Alice will come up on the par three, and it's like the 17th hole at the Tournament Players Club in Jacksonville, or the 17th hole at the Ocean Course in Kiowa. They're so hard. Everybody say they're so hard, but from the ladies' tee, the ladies can play it. And Alice is always working on me to make the par threes difficult because you know where the ladies are going to tee off, or she's going to get that 120, the lady shoots 120, where she's going to tee off.
Yeah, okay. Now, you two came back to Indianapolis after you were done in Rollins. Which high school did Alice go to?
Shortridge.
Shortridge, okay. It's where my dad went. A lot of people went to Shortridge. You came back to Indianapolis. Any particular reason, or did it just
well,
seem...
I married Alice in February of 1950, and I didn't know what to do. So Alice was working at that time for the Connecticut Mutual.
God. I'm sorry. Gosh. I thought I had that off. I will turn it off. Let me go back and ask the question. You two settled in Indianapolis. Any particular reason?
Well, Alice was from Indianapolis, and her family are very prominent in the town. And Alice graduated from Shortridge. And after she came out of Rollins, she started working for the Connecticut Mutual Life Insurance Company. So that's where I ended up with the Connecticut Mutual. And I'm proud to say I was one of the youngest life members of the Million Dollar Roundtable. And I worked here for about 10 years. And then all of a sudden, a farmer south of Indianapolis, Nortzik, he was his name, Mr. Nortzik, called, and he knew I was always interested in the golf course maintenance, and I was on the Greens Committee of the USGA and everything, and he called me to see if I could find somebody to build a golf course for him. And I called, and he didn't have much money, and nobody wanted to work for him. So he finally said, why don't you build it? And I said, I don't know how to build a golf course. But I had tennis elbow, and he said, you ought to come down. And so he had some machinery. So Alice and I went down and built El Dorado. That was our first nine-hole golf course.
And it's still there, right?
Yeah, it's still there. And we thought we built Oakmont. And Alice made a little map of it, showing it to everybody, and sent one to Mr. Tufts. And Mr. Tufts owned Pinehurst, and he's past president of the United States Golf Association. And he wrote us back a very nice letter saying it was wonderful for us kids to build this nine-hole course. But he went on to say, don't you think crossing the creek 13 times in a nine-hole course is just a little too much? Well, anyhow, he was absolutely right. But the following fall, Dr. Harlan Hatcher, president of the University of Michigan, was driving from Ann Arbor, Michigan, down to Indianapolis, going on down to Brown County, see all the artists. And he stopped and played that nine-hole golf course. And he's about a 90 or 100 shooter. So the next thing I knew, I got a call from Dr. Hatcher, said he was going to build a golf course for the University of Michigan. And he'd been talking to Trent Jones and Dick Wilson. And I told him I was in insurance business and didn't know how to draw plans and didn't have a bond, didn't have this. But I went up to see him anyhow. I don't know why I did. I don't remember why I went up there, but I went up to Ann Arbor. And I do remember this, when I walked out of his office, the secretary looked up and said, young man, I don't know who you are or where you're from. President Eisenhower has been up here, and she named all these prominent people in the world have been in there. He said, but nobody has ever been in Dr. Hatcher's office that long.
Oh, wow.
And so the next thing I knew, I built the golf course for the University of Michigan for Dr. Hatcher, and came back and decided I, at that time, I called the Connecticut Mutual, and I was about to take over the office for the state of Indiana and everything else, and called them and told them I was taking an early leave. And they sent a psychiatrist out to see if I lost my mind.
Seriously?
And so...
Are you serious that they sent out?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So I've been digging dirt ever since.
We should mention you had great success in Indianapolis as a golfer yourself. You won the state amateur in 1958.
Yeah.
And you finished second a couple times. You competed in the 1957 U.S. Open. So you certainly were accomplished there. You mentioned you're one of the youngest million-dollar insurance salesmen.
Right.
Just briefly, what was your secret for success there?
I don't know. When I came to Indianapolis, I knew Alice and her family and her cousins, but that's about all I knew, didn't know. But I started peddling and just kept working, and I sold a lot of doctors. I got to sell them doctors, but I had some business insurance, and I wrote some pretty good-sized group insurance. And I don't know how it happened, but it was just lucky, I guess.
Just knocked on the doors.
Just knocked on the doors.
Okay. What's Alice's maiden name?
Her maiden name is O'Neill.
O'Neill.
Her mother's family were the Holiday family, had the Holiday Steel, and they had the largest steel up south of Chicago. And they were all in the steel business,
okay.
Her family, for years and years and years.
Okay. Almost, it sounds like you made a really quick decision to quit insurance and get into golf design.
Well, it was a crazy thing, you know. When Dr. Hatcher called me to build the course, and when we finished it, I just never thought I'd go into the business, but we talked about it, and Alice loved golf, we were in golf, and so we decided to give it a shot.
Were you not enjoying insurance that much? Had it gotten kind of old?
Well, I always liked the insurance business, and it was okay, but I liked digging dirt better, and I've been digging it ever since.
Yeah. You mentioned the nine-hole course, El Dorado, was your first. You and Alice put that together. That was your first effort. Yeah. Was the second one up at Michigan?
No.
The second one was
Heather Hills.
Heather Hills, which is now Maple Creek.
Maple Creek, yeah.
Okay.
And we built that. I remember building that. It was on 80 acres of ground, very tight. And we built 18 holes up there. And then we built it for $80,000, and I got an $8,000 fee. And then when we left, we had it all seated. And the man upstairs was great. He just put a gentle September rain and the grass came up and all. It was fabulous. And so we left to go to Florida. Lady called up to tell Alice she could only find 17 holes. I thought, oh my goodness, don't tell me I just built a 17-hole golf course. But there was a short par 3 out there someplace they found, so got to 18 holes. But it's done quite well since.
Oh yeah, it's a nice course, no question. Have you redesigned it, or is it still your original?
Well, I've gone out to see Mr. Bego, who owns it now, and I've talked to him and made suggestions. And we made a little change in a few minor things, yes.
Okay. So you got $8,000 for that one, huh?
That's right.
Okay. And what was next after that?
I think I did a couple little ones around Indianapolis. I did the one out at west of town, nine holes. What's a little town just west of Indianapolis on 40?
Brownsburg or Plainfield?
Just out that way.
Yeah.
And did nine holes there. Now I got eight. They have 18, and they're doing okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the first major golf course I built was outside of the University of Michigan. It was Crooked Stick and the golf club. I did build one over on Moline, Illinois, where they had the PGA Championship for years, and they rebuilt a new course, and they moved it now. But I built several small golf courses around Indiana. Did a little work at Hillcrest. I did a little work at the country club and things like that. But the Crooked Stick and the golf club were the first two majors I built after the University of Michigan course.
I was going to ask, was there like a breakthrough course design where you established a reputation and people started knocking your door down?
Well, they didn't knock the door down, but I think the Crooked Stick and the golf club from the golf magazines and everything got a rating. So here I was pretty new in a business. And then the next thing, I was always a good friend of Jack Nicklaus. And I knew his dad. And when I was in Ohio, Jack was much younger, but I played with him. And then I played a couple exhibitions with Jack. And the year I was over here in Indianapolis, married, and I went out to the Trans-Mississippi, and who did I run into but Jack Nicklaus is about 16. And I'm surely going to beat him today. And he just beat the devil out of me out there at Trans-Mississippi. So when he makes a speech, he always tells everybody how Pete Dye changed his whole life, because when he won the Trans-Mississippi, he was naturally invited to play in the Masters. And I said, well, how about the following year when I beat you in the National Open? He said, well, that doesn't count. But anyhow, he went to the Masters, and Jack's played ever since. But I've been a good friend of Jack's for many, many years. And I knew his dad quite well.
Yeah, we should mention that the U.S. Open in 1957, in which you competed, you finished ahead of both Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer.
Yeah, yeah. But they're both good friends. So I know Arnold quite well, but I know really Jack's been a really good friend. And Barbara's been a close friend of Alice for years and years. And we lived down there pretty close to each other.
Yeah, okay. And you've helped Jack with his golf course design, I take it.
Yeah, wait. We started out together and thought about working out. And Jack, you know, when he got going on and thinking, he thought, well, he wanted to spread more and draw the plans and have somebody build a golf course. I was always interested in building the golf course. And I design it, but I like to build it. And I don't know why. You got to be either dumb or I don't know why. But I love building golf courses. And like this last couple months, I rebuilt nine holes down in Florida. And I was there 100 days on the job building that nine holes. But I really enjoyed building it. And I've always had two or three fellows that have been following me around, and we built it. And I'm on my way back to the Pete Dye Club, which is now in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And I built that 17 or 20 years ago. And going to do some work on fixing it up. And, you know, a golf course gets 20, 25 years old. They need a little help.
Mm-hmm. You like to get on the equipment?
Well, I used to all the time. But now I got these kids that work a lot better than I do. And you know, the equipment, and talk about golf chains, the balls and the clubs and everything else. But a bulldozer nowadays is computerized so that if you don't know how to run a computer, you can't run a bulldozer.
Okay.
and the same way with all the heavy equipment.
So when you are hired to design a golf course, can you kind of take us through the process? I mean, what do you start with and where do you go from there?
Well, I went down to close by is French Lick, and they took me up on the hill, and it was very severe. And I told them it's going to be hard to make this golf course walkable, and to make it really a good golf course, and to get a notoriety, you have to be able to walk it. So I fussed around and came back and forth and back and forth, and they finally said, "Well, we're going to give you the equipment to make it walkable." Well, fine, I could do that. And we had a D10, which is a tremendous sized bulldozer, for almost 2 years, and two D8s. And we pushed it around down there. And I really love the French Lick golf course, because when you tee off on one and two and three and all the way around the golf course, it's probably one of the highest elevations in Indiana. And they had cut over years and years ago, the forester people cut it over. So the trees had come back for secondary growth. How in the world did that thing get in here? I guess they got it.
Okay.
The secondary growth. And so we took a lot of trees down, and the more I took the trees down, I could see that we were getting these tremendous long views, 20 and 30 miles. And really, when you play the golf course, the ambience, you know, when you play a golf course like Pebble Beach, and the 18th hole is a great hole, no question about it, it's a good, great hole. But to have the Pacific Ocean and Japan, the next thing out of bounds, is unbelievable. And French Lick, when you play the golf course, so many of the holes, from the tee and the landing area or the green, you can turn around and go in 360 degrees, and you can see 20 and 30 miles. And the tree cover is all below you, and of course the trees change color and everything else. So the ambience of the French Lick golf course, I love everything I've done at the ocean course. You got the ocean and teeth of the dog down in the Dominican. I got the ocean to work with, but the ambience there, the 30 miles, it changes. Not like the water just coming in and coming in like this. It'll do you. In the spring, it'll have a certain color from the trees that you see, and then it'll change in the summertime, and then it'll change in the fall. So it's got a great look when you're just walking around. And I never had anybody tell me, hadn't told me, when they play it, they talk about the different holes and how they can see what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So it's really great.
Is that your favorite? Is it possible for you to pick out, "Oh, that's the one I'm really
most proud of?
Well,
you always ask what's your favorite. And here we are at Crooked Stick, and I love Crooked Stick. And it's been changed. Golf has changed tremendously. But I went down to the Dominican Republic in 1968, and they wanted me to build in the capital, and the ground was very poor. Well, I asked them if they owned any more ground. Oh, I said, "Yes, we do," but nobody would go there. I said, "How many acres do you own?" "Oh, we own 560,000. I said, "There got to be a golf course out there." Well, there was a big port they built there, and they had a tremendous sugar company, but the road out there was dirt, and there was no paved road within 20 miles of this property. So I got out there and walked around, and then they had a lot of land right on the ocean, right on the south side of the Dominican Republic, and there was no, they had some pasture on it, but nothing. There was nothing grew there, but the mountains were to the north of us, and there were streams that come down, so you had a big source of water, but they used it on the sugar fields. They had 300,000 or 400,000 acres of sugar. And they're one of the largest producers of sugar in the country, and they make a byproduct from sugar called furfural that goes down in oil wells and castings, and they're big. So I said, "Well, I want to build out here," and they said, "Well, you're crazy." But anyhow, they let me start, because they had a lot of money from the sugar company, and I started. And finally, they were owned by the, they had a lot of Cubans working there, and one gentleman's name was Rudolfo Escobar, and he was a big man in the company, in the sugar company, and he came out, and he stuttered a little bit, and he said, Pete, today I can't speak Spanish or English. We own over 550,000 acres down here, and you're not even building on our land. So they bought that land, and now today they have an airport there that I helped put together. They have an airport that has a wide-body jet from Milan, Italy, flies in there once a week. And they have a plane come in from Miami, the American Airlines fly in there every day. And they got a big marina that we built down there. And see, on the south side of the Dominican, the water is very docile compared to the north side where the ocean, the Atlantic is, it's much more. So a lot of the boats go south of Cuba and south of the Dominican, because it's very docile. And then going to Puerto Rico, they go on the south side. So they, when they built a marina there, I thought, well, this will never work. And it's full. It's been full ever since they built it.
Mm, okay. You went to Scotland in 1963. Mm-hmm. What influence did that have on your career as a designer?
Well, you remember I said I built the University of Michigan golf course. And when I did that, I knew of Trent Jones. And I saw all these different courses he built, one in Columbus and then different places around. And so I copied it, a lot of his work, Mr. Jones. And I knew him quite well. Later on, he would say, Pete, you've done some pretty good work, but your first course up there at the University of Michigan is your best. Yeah. It had a big long tees and bunkers. But anyhow, when I went to Scotland in 63, I had never had an exposure of all the great courses in the East Coast of the United States or Pebble Beach and things like that. So I was amazed. And I got over there and Alice was with me and we played all the courses you could ever heard of in Scotland. And they had railroad ties on practically all of them. And they used all the good golf courses, Turnberry and all of them out there were built along the edge of a railroad track because the people, that's the way the people got to the golf course. And they come out there on the railroad track. And then the track, the railroad tracks would get older, and they'd pick them up. And on the sand dunes, they would erode. So they put the ties against the sand dunes to stop them from eroding, and they made bunkers out of them. So not only on one or two golf courses like Prestwick and all, but they were all over. And so I was amazed to see all the railroad ties. And then I saw the different variety. Like Mr. Jones had a certain type of a bunker he built. And they were great, but there was such a variety of little potholes that had sod walls, and then they had this, and they had that. And I was really amazed with all that. And that year I was lucky I qualified for the British Amateur, played at St. Andrews, and did okay. And then I came back 10 years later and qualified again at St. Andrews. And I won a match or two. And then a fellow from Glasgow, who was a professional roller skater, beat the devil out of me and sent me back home. But that time I also went all over Ireland. And they had some great courses in Ireland too. And Royal Portrush, where they've just recently been on the TV. But I liked a lot of golf courses in Ireland. And they're all, and the golf courses over there you hear about so many times, they're all on sand. And it makes such a tremendous difference of having sand so you can contour and you can let the drainage work this way and that way. And the grass grows so much better. And so in the weather, they get so much rain and then they get drought, but the roots go down so deep, it's all fine. But the great courses you hear in Scotland and Ireland are built on a lot of sand, a lot of sand. Mm-hmm. And in our country, you have some of that out on the Long Island and some up in Maine and some in Michigan. Northern Michigan has on sand. But Indiana and Illinois, where I've been working, it's clay.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
No doubt about it.
When you talked about competing in the British amateur and so forth, did during that time, did you still have any dreams whatsoever as playing, you know, making it as a player, or had you dropped that, you know, a long way back?
I don't think so. In 63, I played pretty good, but I had no ambitions to become a golf professional at that time.
Okay.
And I was doing okay in the insurance business, so and when I started in the building golf courses in 63, all of a sudden, even though I didn't build a lot of big golf courses, I built the golf club and Crooked Stick, spent a lot of time and different courses, and all of a sudden I got so busy, Jack and I talked about going in business together, and Jack wanted to spread, get wide, and I said, no, Jack, I want to stay like it is and build. But I said, we'll be friends and all that. So when you build a golf course, you're tied up for a year, year and a half. And maybe I might have a job going here and run over here or do this and that. But I ran out of time. And even though I played a little golf in the 60s, but I ran out of time of playing. I played, but I didn't work at it like I did before. And so I never, that's the reason I didn't ever think about becoming a PGA Pro. And then another thing, I played with Hogan at Seminole numerous times, you couldn't compete. He was better.
You saw how good you had to be.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, Hogan won more tournaments after he was hurt than anybody for the number he played in. Mm-hmm. But I watched Snead, and I played with Sam, and I played with Mr. Nelson, and I played with a lot of good professionals. And I played in several of their tournaments, and I finished a little amateur in a couple, but still a long ways from winning.
Do you play today?
Oh, I play every Saturday or someplace.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still enjoy it then, obviously.
Oh, yeah, I still enjoy playing, yes.
Yeah. You mentioned that you took courses at Purdue but didn't do well. How long were you taking courses up there?
I knew Dr. Ferguson quite well, and he let me come up to the Ag School, and they had partials down here in Indianapolis at different times, and I just paid the fee to do this, but I was still peddling life insurance, and I'd miss it 2 or 3 weeks, and then I'd go and then miss. But I was always interested in agronomy, and I spent a lot of time with Dr. Ferguson here in Indianapolis, and when he worked around Indiana, so I knew him quite well. And I knew how the ag school up there, see the difference, the farming is one thing, and then agronomy is another. And the ag school was separated from the golf courses at Purdue. The Purdue golf courses were always run by the athletic department. So when I got back years ago and went up to Purdue and saw it, and I got to thinking about it, and I went finally decided to go back, and I talked to Dr. Baring how I thought it ought to be, all the ag school ought to be part of the deal in this, and I talked to him, and I finally said to him, that it takes about $8 million to do all this. He said, well, Mr. Dye, we're really interested in doing this, but he said, we just don't have the funds. So he said, how much do you charge? Would you charge? And I said, well, Dr. Baring, I do all my services for a dollar. And he looked at me and said, well, that's very nice. And then I said, I'll tell you what, I'll raise the $8 million for you. And he jumped out of that chair, shook my hands, and shook it so hard I couldn't believe it. And he said, you got a deal, you're off and running. And I walked out the door and I said, you ought to go back and tell him you're crazy. You don't know anybody from Purdue. You didn't go there. You don't know how to raise the money. You're nuts. And I said, you go back and tell him you're crazy. And then I got in the car and I drove. And I finally got back to Indianapolis, told Alice what I'd done. And she said, get in that car and go back there and tell him you're crazy. But finally we raised most of it myself.
How'd you do it?
Not gonna tell you.
Okay.
No, I had I was lucky. I was lucky. I had a lady, Mrs. Campen, really. And what happened, wasn't doing very good. And I went up to see the girl where they was in charge of raising money for Purdue. She wouldn't give me any names or anything. She said the money had to go to the this history department, that department, so forth. But she said there's a lot of wealthy people from Purdue and in Chicago. So I called the pros up there. I knew all the pros. I wrote them first, didn't get an answer. So one day it was raining, and I said, I don't know why those guys are. Allison, get on the phone. So I called them all, and I just raised the devil with them. And the next thing I knew, I got a call from Dr. Baring, that lady from wanted to see me. It's Mrs. Baring, Mrs. Campen. And Mr. Campen died. And then, so I went up there, and when I went in there, she was sitting at the table, dinner table, and the trustees are there, and there was an empty seat right next to her, and I was a little late, as always, and she was talking to Dr. Baring, and I thought, well, who is this lady? I've never seen her before. I just kept looking at her. And finally, she stopped talking to Dr. Baring. She turned up and said, looked at her and said, Pete, how have you been? Well, I was dumbfounded. And I said, fine, thank you. And she said, and how's dear Alice? How in the world can this lady be sitting in front of me? I have no wild idea who she is. Never seen her before. I know it. And she's talking about Alice and me. And we kept talking, and I was standing there. I sat down, and she said, oh, I said, you know, I'll never forget that night when the fireworks came back over our table. Bingo, I knew where we were. We're in the Dominican Republic on New Year's Day, New Year's Eve, rather. And they have a great big party, or the owners have at their house. And they have all the Latins come in dressed on, fit to kill. And they always have this big table. If you can't speak Spanish, you sit at the Pete Dye table. So that's where she must have been. And then her husband, Mr. Campen, she said, and what was his first name? His first name, I can't think of it, but Mr. Campen, she said, the day he played golf with you was one of the greatest days of his life. I had no idea about it. Oh, yes, I said, yes. So evidently, over Christmas, Mr. Campen was down there, and he must have been standing on the first tee by himself, and I must have said, well, would you like to join us or something, and he did. I have no recollection of that, because I never met him. He died. And I saw his picture, and then I didn't remember this man. And we played golf. And he was, of course, at that table when we had dinner. And she up and gave us a big check. As a matter of fact, when she walked out, she said, oh, I almost forgot. And she reached down in her pocketbook and handed me a check for a couple million dollars, whatever it was. And we got us, that started.
Oh, wow.
And so
what a fluke thing,
yeah,
you know.
So I raised, got it from two or three other people, and from Chicago people, and some from Indianapolis.
So your willingness to do the golf course up there kind of kicked off their whole athletic department renewal of facilities. I mean, yeah. Morgan Burke, the athletic director, told me once that, you know, that was the beginning. Yeah. He had just become the AD, and that was kind of the beginning of...
Yeah, they've got a great practice area up there, and they have for the teaching the kids, and they've... The girls have done quite well.
Mm-hmm.
The boys are fighting, but you know, for a northern school, they've done quite well.
Yeah,
and we're working on some more up there right now. I don't know why. Trying to raise a little bit more money to work on the other golf course, and so we'll wait and see.
Now, when was it you were taking these classes, Purdue agronomy
in 50s,
classes?
In
the
50s. Yes.
Okay, so you felt a connection to the university because of that.
Yeah. I went, when I was peddling life insurance, I was taking all the courses on agronomy.
Okay.
And they had an extension down in Indianapolis, so I would go here. And when I say I was taking them, with Dr. Ferguson and all the material, I was not in there to pass anything, but I've always been interested in agronomy and in the maintenance of a golf course.
Yeah, but you were officially enrolled as a student, right? You weren't just dropping in now and then?
No, I was enrolled, but I would have been thrown out.
Okay, so you would just go...
If I hadn't been a good friend of Dr. Ferguson, I'd have been thrown out long ago.
Okay, so you were just going as your schedule permitted to see what you could learn. Correct. You weren't really a student. Yeah. You weren't taking final exams or anything like that?
No.
Okay,
no,
so when you say you flunked or whatever, you really didn't. You were just...
I was just there. But I've been read everything that's come out of Purdue for the last 50 years. So and every other thing. Michigan State's got a great... See, different schools have an ag school and then they have an agronomy school. Some of the agronomy schools... Even Rutgers has a really good agronomy school. They have no agricultural school, but they're agronomy. Mm-hmm. And Michigan State's a good one. Purdue's pretty good up there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But and it's much better now that they've moved it out where the golf course is, and they got 40 acres to work with, and it's a good school.
Yeah.